Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Strategies to Increase Engagement in HIV Care, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Carlos Del Rio, MD, Heidi M. Crane, MD, MPH, and Connell O'Cleary, PhD. Dr. Del Rio is a professor and chair, Department of Global Health, Rollins School of Public Health, and a co-director, Emory Center for AIDS Research, Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Del Rio has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Merck & Company. He served on the board of directors for the HIV Medicine Association, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and the International Antiviral Society, USA. Dr. Del Rio does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Del Rio does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Crane is an assistant professor of medicine, associate director, clinical epidemiology and health services, research core centers for AIDS research, University of Washington, Seattle, Washington. Dr. Crane has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Crane does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Crane does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. O'Cleary is an instructor, Harvard Medical School, Associate Director, Behavioral Medicine, Department of Psychiatry, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. O'Cleary has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. O'Cleary does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. O'Cleary does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to recognize common barriers to linkage to and retention in care for HIV-positive patients and to provide tools and strategies to reduce or overcome those barriers. This activity is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb Company and Gilead. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is Dr. Carlos Del Rio, and I'm professor and chair in the Department of Global Health at the Rollins School of Public Health and professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Emory University School of Medicine. I'm also co-director for clinical sciences and international research of the Emory Center for AIDS Research. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Heidi Crane, who's assistant professor at the University of Washington Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, University of Washington at Harborview Medical Center, and Dr. Connell O'Cleary, who's instructor at Harvard Medical School, as well as associate director of behavioral medicine at the Department of Psychiatry at the Massachusetts General Hospital. I'd like to welcome you to this roundtable discussion entitled Strategies for Increasing Engagement in HIV Care. As part of the CME activity, we will discuss some of the facilitators and barriers to linkage and retention in care for HIV patients that have been identified to date. In this day and age, when we think about an HIV-infected individual, we need to think not only about them having an infectious with a virus, but also the additional factors that may bring them into care, such as mental illness, substance abuse, other infectious diseases such as tuberculosis or sexually transmitted infections, and social issues like poverty. These issues, which by themselves were the cause of them acquiring HIV, are also important factors in the ability to have them respond to therapy, engage in care, and ultimately benefit from antiretroviral therapy. Today, in order for persons to benefit from treatment success, what kinds of things do you think are necessary for our patients to have?
I liked particularly that last slide, Carlos. I think the idea that it's the intersection of various different vulnerabilities that interfere with people's ability to manage their disease, substance use, mental health, and poverty. I think it's really important to emphasize that.
I think what happens is frequently we think that, you know, we diagnose people and then we get them on therapy and that's really it. But the fact is, I think we are increasingly recognizing that you diagnose somebody with HIV infection, but then you really need to link them to outpatient care. You need to get them start antiretroviral therapy. You have to get patients to adhere to therapy, but you also have to get patients to adhere to the clinic. You have to retain them in care. And each one of those steps, I think, is potential points where we may lose patients.
And I think, as you said, to some of those issues that may interfere with their ability to be linked into care, excuse me, are the same things that may have made them vulnerable to HIV infection in the first place, substance use and depression or anxiety.
Heidi, why do you think it's important that we really focus on this adherence to the clinic, not just adherence to therapy?
There's been a number of studies that have demonstrated the importance of focusing not just on adherence to medication and steps further down on the spectrum that you were just mentioning, but focusing early on. And I think if we could talk a little bit about some of the studies that have demonstrated how many people fall out of care between the time they get diagnosed and the time they get enrolled in care, or how many people are seen in clinic only the first time and then don't follow up and aren't engaged in care over the long period.
Sure. I think we're using terms right now that we better define. We talk a lot about linkage to care, retention in care, engagement in care. But what do these terms really mean? How are they different? And why is it important for providers to understand what each one of these terms really means? You want to describe maybe linkage to care?
Sure. So there's a number of ways of defining this, but focusing specifically on linkage to care, typically what we're referring to is entry into outpatient care after the time of HIV diagnosis. And what we want to emphasize there probably is that it's not just when a patient gets diagnosed in the ER or an STD clinic or another setting, that linkage to care is not simply having the patient receive a referral to a clinic, but some sort of more engaged and active process to really getting them to that first appointment and getting them linked into clinical care. The second definition you mentioned was retention in care, and that's really a longer-term definition. It's really the continuous involvement in outpatient care over time, and there's a number of ways that that's defined. There's a number of definitions in terms of missed visits and other ways of defining it, but it's really being seen in clinic over time. And then the final term is engagement in care, and that's that term involves sort of the whole process from linkage to retention to longitudinal follow-up and all of the processes and factors that contribute to whether patients engage in care and whether they stay in care and how much health services they're using and accessible to them and that they take advantage of.
And maybe to throw in into that definition of engagement in care, I really like the way you described that, Heidi, is also the number of different skills that the patient can bring to being fully engaged, including adhering to their medication, adhering to the treatment plan more broadly, developing a good working relationship with their physician and other healthcare providers, and being as fully engaged in the process of their own healthcare as they can.
I think several years ago, as you can see in this graph, Laura Cheever really showed us very nicely that this really is a spectrum. It's a continuum in engagement and care that goes from really not being in care. We know there's a certain percentage of the population which don't even know they're HIV infected, to those that are really fully engaged. And as I said, the patients we really like to take care of. And in the midst of all this, there's really a continuum that we need to define and emphasize. In a recent study, we estimated that this continuum really is a very leaky pipe. Approximately 75% of individuals who are HIV infected are actually linked to care within 6 to 12 months of diagnosis. And of those, probably somewhere around 50% then remain engaged in care or are not engaged in care long term. Once you're engaged in care, you're quite likely to be started antiretroviral therapy if you need them, but there's still a percentage of people who should be on antiretroviral therapy is not getting antiretroviral therapy for a variety of reasons. And of those getting antiretroviral therapy with the modern drugs, close to 80% of them are virologically suppressed. The challenge, obviously, behind this is that if you really think of the entire country having maybe slightly over a million HIV-infected individuals, it really is a small percentage of individuals who are actually virologically suppressed. So when we think about treatment as prevention, when we think about treatment being able to really impact HIV transmission at a population level, we got to do better than this. We got to diagnose more people. We got to link those that we diagnose into care. We got to keep them in care and get them an antiretroviral therapy. And that's precisely what we're talking about at this roundtable.
And that graph really, I think, correctly focuses our attention on how important it is to link and engage. Absolutely.
I think the other point that graph shows is that there are so many different steps where we're losing patients, and we need to focus and do better at each and every one of those steps.
And I think in a recent editorial, when talking about test and treat as a strategy in this country, in a recent editorial by Dr. Diefenbach and Fauci, I think it's pretty clear that they understand this, that they clearly say we need to come up with better ways to enter patients into care and retain patients in care. I think clearly the NIH, clearly the funders, the agencies are recognizing that these are steps that are very, very important, and not simply just giving medications to patients. So let's just discuss in some detail some of the barriers and challenges that may preclude HIV-infected patients from entering care. What do you guys see as sort of the major challenges as far as the first step, linking somebody to care? Once somebody's diagnosed with HIV, what are the factors that prevent them from then entering care after diagnosis?
I think when people are diagnosed with HIV in medical care settings that are well used to providing the full range of HIV treatment services, maybe linkage to care is straightforward. But because HIV is now being diagnosed in settings that are not traditionally used to treating HIV, linkage to care becomes much more important, where we go beyond just providing basic referral information and actually hook people into care. And I think there are a number of different strategies to help with that and increase the success of that.
I think there's a couple of other things to keep in mind as well. I think there's some barriers at the patient level that are pretty important to getting patients linked in into clinical care, and those, I think, are themes we're going to hear throughout this discussion, coming back to the very important themes of substance use and depression and stigma, which I think we'll talk more about.
Yeah, I mean, I clearly think that, as you well stated, it's not just providing somebody a referral, but really doing this linkage component, this really making sure that we get you into care. And we do it soon. I think that the sooner we get somebody into care, the more likely that they actually are to remain stayed in care. Are there any particular issues around, 50% of the epidemic or more in this country is men who have sex with men? Are there any particular issues that have been seen as barriers among men who have sex with men?
I think that's a great question, and one of the, when we come back again to looking at what the vulnerabilities are that make particular groups vulnerable for HIV, some of those continue to get in the way of people managing the disease appropriately. And I think increasingly as HIV adopts a poverty profile, domestically anyway, I think we see some of those poverty issues getting in the way. In addition, people who are less well-resourced, less able to engage and negotiate their way through what can be a complex healthcare system. Minority, MSM, African American, men who have sex with men, and Latino men who have sex with men. Certainly, there's good data to suggest that they may be at particular risk around the maintaining their engagement in care. And we know too that particular substance use issues and particular mental health issues, particularly depression and history of particular kinds of trauma, may make it increasingly difficult for MSM to stay engaged in care.
So given these challenges, what interventions have been used by practitioners and by the system to address some of the challenges that we're talking about?
I think there's a number of things that have been tried. Some of these have more supportive data than others, but I think they're all sort of small steps in the right direction. And these include more emphasis on rapid testing, so getting the results back to the patient while the patient is still there and getting them linked into care before they have left and you've lost them. And then the idea of making a positive test or a positive HIV test the sort of critical action value so that you really make sure that it's not just a referral that's handed to the patient, but a much more comprehensive and systematic systematic approach to getting them integrated into clinical care. And then attempts at immediate referral about how to get into care and where to go for your HIV provider, and much more support for case management, people who follow up when they don't get seen, when they don't keep their visits, when it, in a more comprehensive way. And then finally, more emphasis on addressing some of the substance use, alcohol use, and depression issues that are seen repeatedly.
I think also there's some data supporting the use of healthcare navigators, people who are charged with a degree of outreach, and then linking the newly diagnosed HIV positive patient into care. And as Heidi was saying, some primary care settings have adopted a medical case management model where your contact with the clinic or the agency where you're receiving services is at a case management level, and there's a level of support around meeting each of your mental health and medical health needs.
I think, as you mentioned, I think there are two separate issues. One is just helping patients and newly diagnosed individuals who are scared or challenged by a new diagnosis, just navigating the healthcare system. You and I know how difficult getting into healthcare is, and we work in healthcare, but if you're not in there, I would find it incredibly challenging to know where to make my appointment, what to do, what kind of paperwork do I need to bring. But then there's the other issue, which is more the case management component, which is I'm coming to the healthcare system, but I'm also concerned about housing, I'm concerned about my job, I'm concerned about insurance, I'm concerned about my kids. And at the end of the day, I need both. I need the patient navigator, I need that case management, I need really all the support. Otherwise, all those other issues are going to pull me away from what I find is a pretty scary environment, which is healthcare. There's one intervention that has been tried and tested in a randomized controlled trial, and that's the ARTIS intervention. This was an intervention designed by the CDC to test in a case management intervention to test entry into care compared to just a standard referral. And what the ARTIS intervention showed is by this active case management, they were more likely to get patients linked to care. They were more likely to get patients to stay in care. But I think some of the things that the ARTIS intervention also showed us is that clients that are recruited shortly after diagnosis, and shortly was defined here as 180 days after an HIV diagnosis, are more likely to enter care. Again, emphasizing that if you were diagnosed a year ago and you didn't enter care, you're probably not interested in entering care. It's going to be harder to get you into care. But the other issue is the challenge that is faced by certain things like some drugs, for example, crack cocaine. And I'm sure if we had done this now, we would find the same thing with crystal meth. So I think even when we think about substance abuse, I think there's certain substances that are, not all substances are equal, basically. Can you tell us about how, what are the issues with substance abuse? I mean, what do we need to worry with substance abuse and mental health? How do we deal with it? And is it really a problem among our patients?
I think number of different issues spring directly to mind. One is, I think that mental health issues like depression or anxiety or trauma history and substance use problems like cocaine dependence or methamphetamine dependence often co-occur. People who are likely to have a mental health issue are also more likely to have a substance use problem. And both of those interact to really interfere with optimal HIV disease management. And they can get in the way of not just people being linked to care initially, but also being sustained in care. Among gay and bisexual and other men who have sex with men, there are particular substance use profiles that we maybe want to keep an eye on. Methamphetamine dependence, for example, may be particularly more relevant in that population. The other thing in among men who have sex with men who are attending primary care HIV clinics, very high rates of mood disorders, depression and other mood disorders co-occur with substance use, but also oftentimes go undiagnosed or underdiagnosed. So close to 40% of people with depression in primary care settings have not been diagnosed, and this is an interfering problem with care. So it's maybe one of our priorities then would be to increase our ability to be able to detect some of those.
So when we're thinking about detecting this issue, substance abuse, mental health, What do we do? Do we just do it? We typically tend to do it at entry into care. We get a history. But is it something more than we can do? For example, can you tell us about what other approaches can be used to collecting this information?
Yes. So what often happens in clinical care is the provider diagnoses it when they note that a patient has a depression issue or a substance use issue. And what's been shown multiple times in both non-HIV primary care clinics and specialty clinics as well as HIV clinics is that that sort of approach drastically underestimates the rates of depression and the rates of substance use. It's very difficult sometimes for a patient to report to a provider some of these potentially stigmatizing behaviors, and sometimes it's very difficult for a provider to distinguish some of the symptoms of depression that are truly related to depression versus just attributing them to HIV or other illnesses. Therefore, an approach that's being used more and more often is looking at patient-reported outcomes collection, and what this means is that the patient completes an assessment that is completed out not by the provider, but a self-reported assessment before they see the provider. And this one provides more time for the provider to act on whatever needs to be addressed, doesn't take crucial time out of the appointment time, but also addresses some of these underdiagnosing issues that are so crucial, particularly among our HIV patients in domains such as substance use. So patients will complete a brief clinical assessment before they see the provider that includes domains such as depression and substance use, as well as these other clinically relevant patient-reported outcome domains. This has been shown to enhance the patient-provider communication. It provides the provider with information they wouldn't otherwise know, leading to improved clinical care, as well as also provides valuable data that may facilitate future research and additional studies on retention and outcomes in patients with HIV. There's a number of approaches to this that can be done, including interviewer-based, patient-based, and electronic or touchscreen tablet-based. Although interviewer-based is often expensive, it also results in less accurate responses. So at this point, the standard of care is really to do an electronic approach, which has a slightly greater startup cost but has so much less cost over time because it eliminates data entry time and the errors that are incorporated in that. And it allows less impact on patient flow and lower costs over the long term and allows programming in multiple languages. And finally, it has a much less impact on patient burden because it allows skip patterns to be easily incorporated, allowing patients to be items to be targeted really at the patients as they should be.
So can you give us an example of how this is being used? I mean, it sounds interesting, but is this actually being used nowadays?
I can. The Scenix cohort, which is a cohort collaboration of 8 clinical sites in the United States, have really taken an aggressive approach to trying to deal with some of these socio-behavioral issues in clinical care. And Scenix measures Scenix follows clinical outcomes among HIV patients. All of these clinics have an electronic health record, and this data is integrated into a clinical information system, allowing changes in outcomes and clinical care to be tracked basically virtually in real time. Their approach to the patient-reported outcomes is patients complete a brief assessment before they meet with their provider, the results of which are given to the provider on the same day. At this point, somewhere over 11,000 clinical assessments have been done to date in Scenix, providing a wealth of clinical data as well as being used to, more importantly, focus on improving clinical care. And data from the Scenix cohort has shown that integrating patient-reported outcomes and providing that feedback to the providers at the time of clinical visits can impact provider identification and awareness of at-risk alcohol use, depression, as well as how often the provider thinks the patient is adhering well to their meds when they are, in fact, adhering poorly.
So it seems to me it's almost like getting vital signs. But you're looking at vital signs around behavioral issues.
That's exactly right. And in many clinics, including ours, we incorporate that as part of the vital signs. This is considered a key part of our clinical care, and therefore that's exactly right. It's done and tracked as much as any other vital sign.
And it allows the provider then to make a decision and to make an intervention if necessary.
Exactly.
And these are brief and efficient assessments that are done too. It means that they're sustainable in many settings. Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about substance abuse, I sometimes get concerned that people just sort of lump everything together. And, you know, we frequently say, you know, 40% of our patients have ever used substance. But really, a lot of times that includes people who have stopped using a drug versus people who are actively using. How common is it for people in our clinics to to be actively using substances, and what are the substances that we're concerned about from our HIV management issue, for example, you know, adherence and other biological outcomes.
Some of the data that's on this slide shows current substance use among a subsample of the CNICS cohort, nearly 3,500 patients with HIV. And on this we see that over 40% of that sample are using marijuana, and one in four are using amphetamines, and just under 10% are using crack cocaine. Some of the other things that are demonstrated here that I think are very notable, mentioned by Heidi too, that the rates of depression are extremely high in this sample, and as are the rates of medication non-adherence. And it doesn't really matter how we look at adherence in terms of the time frame that we're asking people to recall, but for those reporting in the previous month, more than one in three are reporting adherence difficulties. And if we look also at the relationship between those adherence problems and substance use, we see that all substances are not the same, in fact, that use of different substances is associated with dramatically different risk of adherence problems, with intravenous drug use being associated with nearly an eightfold increase in the risk of adherence problems, and amphetamines with more than three times the risk, and marijuana nearly one and a half times the risk of adherence problems. So these are not minor relationships. These are important impediments to how well people can stay engaged in their own care.
So now that we've talked about some issues, are there any models that are being tried out there that can increase retention and care by addressing substance abuse and mental health?
So I think that's one of the key questions, and many of these models are still in development. I think when we look at the interplay and the that so many of these problems co-occur, that it's important to have integrated treatment models available that can either be used to address depression in a primary care setting or used to address adherence in a substance use treatment setting, so that we can essentially address these problems where people are currently receiving care and receiving treatment. And we've had some success in some of our development models where we're looking to address medication adherence directly in the presence of patients who are dealing with major depression and also dealing with substance use dependence. And one of the things that we found is that the more success that we have in treating depression, the bigger the bang for the buck folks are getting out of the adherence intervention that we hit them with. So to the extent that we can treat depression, the people's medication adherence improves over time.
We have actually also done it at Grady. We have actually tried a model, and this again emphasizes for a small population of patients which are highly difficult to manage, non-adherent not only to a therapy but also non-adherent to the clinic, we have tried an integrated model which we call a transition clinic. And this is a place where we try to integrate primary care, substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment. And really, on our preliminary data, which was presented at CROI this past year, you can see very nicely that when we looked at patients before entering the transition center and after entering the transition center, clearly they were more likely to be engaged in care and more likely to be virologically suppressed once they entered a clinic where a comprehensive care is given. And again, it's very hard to know sort of a cause and effect, but clearly it emphasizes that there was something in this integrated clinic that clearly made the patients more likely to stay engaged in care. And I think it has to do with a lot of what you're saying, is treatment of their depression, is addressing their substance abuse issues together at the same time that we're addressing their HIV. That really makes a difference. And at the end of the day, what you want to do is make a difference in virological outcomes. You want people to be benefiting from these life-saving therapies that we currently have available.
And if I could just throw in a point to add on to that, Carlos, I think one of the things that's worth emphasizing is what those programs have in common, perhaps, and one is that they're skill-based programs. We're actually teaching people, increasing their skill level at controlling their depression or doing harm reduction around their substance use so that they can be more effective patients and more effective partners in managing their own disease. And also, I think there's a priority there around developing sustainable interventions and making sure that we're implementing these programs in real-world settings so that they can be sustained after the initial research initiative maybe has moved on.
Absolutely. I think the issue of sustainability and the issue of how do we make this be, because increasingly it's going to be an issue in our clinics. I think this population is not decreasing, but in fact that's where the epidemic is going. So how if you were going to estimate in some studies from the literature how frequent it is to have patients with in our HIV-infected clinics, to have people that have mental illness, that have substance abuse, or that have both, is it something that is rare? Is it frequent? Give us some percentages maybe from some studies.
Sure. So we've looked at a couple of different studies that have looked in several of them the prevalence of depression is 40% and higher. In one recent study, they found that 63% of patients had a mental illness, 45% had a substance use disorder, and 38% of patients had both. So these are very high, very prevalent problems. An interesting finding from that study, however, that emphasizes again, the need to really be tracking and identifying these problems and addressing them is that although patients with substance use or patients who had depression were much less likely to initiate antiretroviral therapy compared to those without them, those patients with depression who then received treatment for depression were just as likely to initiate treatment with antiretroviral therapy as those who were not who did not have depression, again, reminding us of how important it is to identify and treat these patients.
And providing support for the integrated treatment model.
Yeah, too. Exactly. Systematically approaching.
But also makes us realize that while this is common, we can also do something about it and we can actually improve outcomes in our patients. This is not a lost battle, but it's actually an issue of identifying and treating it.
Exactly.
So how do we do this in a way, again, you talked about sustainability. How do you package these things?
I think some of the priorities for these kinds of this kind of programming initiative around building an integrated treatment model is to have a skills-based program that's flexible enough to be used in a community care setting or to be used in a substance use treatment setting. So having flexible, maybe modular-based programs that are well-specified so they're easily replicable and transportable in different settings, I think that's a big part. That when we talk about engagement in care, that we make sure we're talking about very specific, trainable, skill-based things like communication with one's provider, like skills around adhering to medication, like how to handle slips in medication adherence, how to become good problem solvers. That these are all skill-based strategies that can be taught in a well-specified curriculum. I think another thing that helps with these kinds of programs is that we don't rely on very highly trained personnel, doctoral level psychologists or MD physicians to be able to implement these programs because they just won't be sustainable. So having a thought to scaling up when we're designing these programs, that we're actually looking at who the behavior change agents are going to be. Are they going to be case managers? Are they going to be nurses? Are there going to be master-level social workers who are there already in those kinds of settings and can support this kind of programming? The other thing I would say, and one of the programs that I'm thinking about is the Life Steps program. It has been, we've got some good evidence that that can be integrated into treatment for depression, so we can hit adherence and depression in integrated programs and address the complexity of those problems at the intersection of those problems. The Life Steps program, we also have some really nice efficacy data that it can be implemented effectively in substance treatment facilities among people who are managing not just HIV, but HIV and depression and opiate dependence at the same time. So I think that's the wave of the future, skill-based modular programs.
So let's move a little bit into retention and care. We said at the beginning, a lot of people talk about retention, but how do we measure retention? How do we know if somebody is retaining care? Is there any good measures of retention?
There's been several commonly used definitions to measure retention in care, including missed visits, adherence to appointments, a definition of visit constancy, looking at gaps in care, so how long a period a patient goes without having a visit. There's a number of different definitions, and it's not really clear yet what the gold standard, what the correct definition is.
So I think we, at the end of the day, we want the patient, though, to have the best outcomes. So maybe we need to focus less on really this defining what retention is, but really look at, did the patient get virologically suppressed? Did we reach the outcomes that we actually are interested in reaching? Did we treat their depression, et cetera? Because I can imagine seeing a patient that maybe comes to clinic every month, but basically ignores anything I tell him, or I can see another one that comes to clinic every 6 months and takes their medications and does fine, and one could be more retained but less successful than the other one. So I think maybe we need to focus less on actually defining the term. But clearly HRSA and other organizations are increasingly, Ryan White, are looking at measures of retention as even indicators of good quality of care. So I think it's something that we need to pay attention to. Interventions for retention and care that have been tried, there really are not very many out there, but Can you mention a few that have been tried? I know, for example, there's been a SPINS outreach intervention that has been tried. Other interventions that are out there, anything that you guys are aware of that exist?
Well, I think some of those studies are underway, and a lot of that data isn't in yet. Mm-hmm. As to what are the, we have an idea of what the models mm-hmm. might look like, but I think the data is we're still waiting.
I think we need to see what the studies show. Contingency management. We hear people talk about contingency management. It's something that has been used for quite some time, I think, in substance abuse. It has been used in treatment of alcohol disorders. It's a way to really to reinforce a desired behavior and to withhold or reinforce or even punish an undesirable behavior. So is this something that should be tried? Is this something that can be looked at in adherence to HIV care and treatment?
I don't think we yet have data on whether on how big an impact it has. We know that it's very useful in some other settings, like substance abuse, as you mentioned, but I don't think we know in terms of retention and linkage to care. And one concern when we're thinking about contingency management, as you had mentioned earlier, is being very cognizant of the ability or the need to be able to scale it up to broad-scale clinics, which may be a bit tricky with contingency management approaches. But we don't have the data yet, I think, to know how useful it'll be.
And just following on from Heidi's point there, one of the things that we find in one of our cohorts is that ongoing substance use, particularly ongoing cocaine use, interferes with the ability of patients to sustain the adherence gains that they've made on the basis of one of our interventions. So maybe there is a role for contingency management to support substance use treatment in adherence programming throughout the whole spectrum of being involved in care.
So when we talk about the challenges of engaging patients in care, there's certain things that can be done, which are improving trust, communication, reducing stigma, or removing structural barriers, treating substance abuse, treating and diagnosing mental health issues, especially depression. But are there any other issues that you think we could try to really improve this engagement in care?
There are clinics who are currently focusing on looking at ways of improving linkage and retention by shortening their appointment times, making it very easy to get patients into the clinic and immediately seen or seen very shortly after they make their first attempt to engage. There's other things that could be tried include extending clinic hours, again, sort of focusing on making it as easy as possible and making it as easy as possible to navigate the system in terms of health insurance and health and just getting through the healthcare system and making sure that there's appropriate and adequate staffing, that there's somewhere for patients to go, patients to be seen with not only providers but also case management and the support services needed.
There's also some developing models. And maybe the data isn't entirely in on this either, but the use of developing and emerging technology to support engagement and care around using phone-based text messaging.
SMS and other technologies like that.
To remind patients of their appointments, and also there's been a couple of studies done where those text messages are interactive. So it's not just for reminding patients, but it's also a vehicle for patients to stay connected with their healthcare providers also.
But I think at the end of the day, really a lot of the challenges really are translation, dissemination, and sustainability. I think we have issues with staffing and resources already in our clinics, and I think at the end of the day is really how are we going to be able to sustain these efforts and what is the most cost-effective way of actually achieving these goals. So in summary, I mean, when you think about addressing these issues and leading to poor outcomes, I think the data is beginning to be very clear that if we don't have patients come to clinic, if patients miss appointments, they're more likely not to be virologically suppressed, and therefore they're more likely not to benefit from antiretroviral therapy. So I think at the end of the day, what we want to do is really to establish the necessary interventions to address all those issues that are interfering with a patient's ability to be in care, and really look at patients who are no-shows as sort of a sentinel event that maybe is telling us something else that is happening with the patient. It may be that, in fact, there's substance abuse, there's mental health, there's other issues in those no-show patients that, in fact, are driving some of the poor outcomes that we're beginning to see with our patients.
I think also, Carlos, one of the things I would add to that is that it's important to recognize that the pathway to poor engagement or lack of involvement in care are multiple and various, and that there's a level of individualized assessment of the initiatives like CNIX that Heidi was talking about really help get us to specify what's going on with each individual patient who has difficulty sustaining their level of engagement and involvement in their own care and intervening on those individual profiles.
I want to thank my colleagues, I want to thank Medscape, and to you, the viewers, for joining us in this interesting discussion. You may now take the CME post-test at the Earn CME link. Please also take a moment to complete the program evaluation that follows. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Strategies to Increase Engagement in HIV Care. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.